This You've is been a listening 3CR to a 3CR podcast, podcast produced in the studios produced of independent community radio station in Melbourne, 3CR, Australia.
In Melbourne,
go
Australia.
To all the W's. For more information, go to all the W's. 3CR.org.au.
We've done it. We've done the impossible. We're back. As I keep telling you, it's like that bad smell that you can smell. You don't know what it is, and then you realise you've stood on dog shit. Well, that's the Anarchist World this week. Now, look at that. Somebody's made a noise. I don't know why they're making noises. Why do they make noises? Right, here we are. See, it's an old man just meandering. Now, if you want to hear an old man meander, tonight at the Footscray Hotel, 48 Hopkins Street in Footscray, the last traditional pub left in Melbourne town, if not Australia, doesn't serve food, but you can bring your own food, but there's lots of alcohol and soft drinks and things in packets. There'll 6:30 p.m. for a 7 p.m. start. I'll be doing a presentation where I'll be comparing the reform agenda of the Whitlam-led Labor government, which was in power for 1,061 days, in comparison to the agenda of the Albanese-led Labor government, which has been in power over 1,000 days also. And those of you who lived through that period will be fascinated to find out how many of the advantages we have today are directly related to that reform agenda. It was a reform agenda based on the redistribution of wealth. So you're all welcome. There's no cover charge, obviously. You can, you know, meet some like-minded people. If you can't make it, relax. The program will be televised, as they say, and it'll be put on the YouTube channel, josephtoscano.nam, by the end of the week or early next week. So you can always access that. If you are interested in YouTubes, I do a presentation every week, and if you go to Public Interest Before Corporate Interest YouTube channel, there's over 330 YouTube presentations on various topics, and this week's presentation will be on that Whitlam-led Labor government reform agenda. Now, next week, the last Wednesday of the month, yes, it's nearly the end of the year. Next week, on the last Wednesday of the month, we'll be having dinner down at Frankston at La Porchetta, 6:30 p.m. start. And don't forget the Thursday, the 9th of October, is Peter Norman Day, and we'll be gathering at midday at Orfiki Drive, where the athletics track is down in was it South Melbourne? So we'll be there. I'll tell you more about that next week. So put that in your calendar. And if you can't make that, there's other things. There's the Murchison Francesco Fantine Memorial Gathering, which will be on Sunday, the 9th of November, starting at 10 a.m. And if you can't make that, guess what? There's Eureka Day, the 3rd of December. So there's lots of things happening, and then obviously next year there's Tanaminua Morbohina commemoration on the 20th of January. So there's plenty of things happening, and don't forget the vigil on the steps of the Victorian Parliament House, public housing, everybody's business. The sacred cows have come in. Sydney's about to take us who knows where. Well, well, we're back. This is the Anarchist World This Week, coming to you from the studios of the 3CR in Melbourne. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. My name's Joseph Toscano. The program is broadcast across Australia, north to south, east to west, and all the islands around this continent by the... here we go. Let's move on. The Community Radio Network. Yes, the Community Radio Network. Where would we be without the Community Radio Network? Now, I'd like to start off, well, start off the definition. What's anarchy? Anarchos without rulers? Very simple. Not without rules. Without rulers. R-U-L-E-R-S. What gives rulers the ability to determine the lives of billions of people? inequalities in power and wealth. So the anarchist struggles the struggle to devolve or share power, possibly through direct democratic means, and the struggle to hold wealth in common and use it for the common good. Simple concepts. Now, obviously, the problem is creating that society. And in order to create that society, we need to understand what's happening around us. Because it's very, very easy in a world which is dominated by the World Wide Web, it's exceptionally easy to get lost in the forest and not understand where the real problem lies. Because it's always easy to, you know, blame the other person for your problems, isn't it? Maybe it was your upbringing. Maybe it was your parents. Maybe it's the person who wears the funny hat, who's got a different coloured skin, or talks a different language. But ultimately, human history is about power and wealth. It's about the concentration of power and wealth and how that means that the majority, a huge majority of the world's populations since time immemorial, have found themselves to be nothing more than hostages to powerful interests. As I said before, the anarchist struggle is that struggle to share power, hold wealth in common. Now, a lot of people think that if you leave human beings to their own devices, we'll spend all our time killing, raping, murdering each other. But the fact is that what we have in the world today, and Gaza is a classical example, and what's happened in the Ukraine is another classical example, of what happens when power is concentrated in the hands of a minuscule minority, whether that those people are elected or self-appointed or hereditary rulers. The fact is that's that power they're able to wield at that point, which is the main issue. Now, I have noticed, I'm sure you've all noticed, that migration has once again become the bête noire of Australian history. So I want to talk about migration today and just try to explain the role of migration in Australian society and why so many people feel ostracised and marginalised. Look, you and I know that colonisation began in 1788. You and I know that the original inhabitants were forcefully dispossessed. And you and I know the history, although many other Australians don't. So migration began in 1788 when the British government, having lost its American colonies and a place to dump its excess prisoners, not prisoners of war, but prisoners of a grossly hierarchical society, a grossly unequal society, decided that Sydney Cove, Port Jackson, would be just the place to set up a penal colony. Within 50 years of that penal colony being established, people began to realise, as the original inhabitants were murdered and driven off their lands, that there was an opportunity for Europeans to make a buck. And we saw the beginning of a migration process where people were offered free land, a little bit like West Papua today with the Indonesian government's transmigration program, where the original inhabitants are forced off their lands in the most violent ways, and then obviously land is reallocated to people who've got find themselves in a difficult economic situation and are happy to access that land to improve the situation, their situation, and the situation of the people they support. So we saw this growth of migration. Now, I've always had this pressure or this issue regarding migration. And if you look at early Australian history, it's replete with examples of where a majority, concerned about competition amongst different groups, racial groups, whether they were Chinese, South Sea Islanders, you know, Africans, were very keen to keep their patch. But the whole point since migration began is that migrants were seen as a cheap labour source. And whether they were shepherds, who were ticket of leave men mainly, and a few women, looking after the squatter sheep, were there people looking for gold? The fact is that the number of people who migrated to this continent continued to increase. And by the time Federation occurred in 1901, there was a movement to keep Australia white. Not just European, because Southern Europeans weren't welcome, but white. And it's interesting to see the first two acts of the Federated Parliament in 1901 were, one, the introduction of the White Australia policy, and two, the introduction of the Kanak expulsion policy, where over 20,000 South Sea Islanders who'd been kidnapped, the majority of cases, were indentured labourers to work on the cane fields, were deported back to the Pacific. So between 1901 and World War II, Australia was basically a white enclave. The original inhabitants had been massacred, their land had been taken, they were considered to be a dying race, and things plugged along. After World War II, when we saw the Japanese bomb Broome, take over most of Papua New Guinea, bomb Darwin, Thursday Island, Horn Island, and other parts of North Australia, the government of the day, the Chifley-led Labor government, embarked on a populate or perish immigration campaign. Populate or perish. And faced with the possibility of what was described as a communist-led invasion by the yellow hordes of Northern Asia, we saw the opening up of the migration policy to refugees from a devastated Europe and unskilled labourers and farmers from Southern Europe. Now, obviously, that had created tensions within the community. And if you look at the period in the late 1940s, 1950s, you can see multiple reports regarding physical confrontations between the new migrants and the old migrants. In 1972-73, the Whitlam-led Labor government removed the last vestiges of the White Australia policy and passed the Racial Discrimination Act, which opened up Australia's borders to an increasing number of non-European migrants. And to a significant degree, this occurred because of the privatisation, globalisation, corporatisation, deregulation, economic model, which took hold of this country in the early 1980s during the Hawke-Keating period. This meant that the economic basis of Australia had been revolutionised in terms of shutting down manufacturing and businesses and corporations exporting manufacturing to countries which were non-unionised, which paid workers a pittance in order to maximise their profits. As far as agriculture is concerned, the expansion of agribusiness into the agricultural sector didn't necessarily mean a huge increase in taxation revenue for the federal government. And the fact that manufacturing had disappeared, an increase in unemployment had occurred, there was a real issue in terms of the economic basis of the country. At the same time, we saw the resources sector of this country plundered by both national and international corporations, where resources were removed and continued to be removed, and what Australians received in return were minuscule returns, maybe 10 cents in $100. So it was a huge problem. How does business keep the economy afloat when only 2% of people work in the mining sector, a small percentage work in the agricultural sector? So what we needed, what happened during this period, was governments increasing migration in an attempt to create revenue, a little bit like a Ponzi scheme, a Ponzi economic scheme. So you increase migration to create revenue. Because there's no manufacturing base, you need to create a surface industry where, we basically sell things to each other as a population. At the same time that migration numbers were increased to sustain the Australian economy, because we weren't getting enough returns from agriculture and the resources sector, what we saw is unscrupulous employers and corporations using this increase in migration to put downward pressures on wages. At the same time, we saw the virtual destruction of the trade union movement, which today only represents about 10% of Australian workers, and the significant number of them are public servants at the state and federal level. So the greatest losers in this Ponzi migration scheme were not businesses and were not large businesses and corporations. They'd continued to maximise profits for their major shareholders by exploiting people who'd come to this country as migrants, exploiting their labour and their skills. So what we saw is that many people who found themselves in semi-skilled or unskilled jobs, as we saw in the 19th century, were pushed out of work. And if you're not a wage earner in a capitalist society, your ability to enjoy the fruits of the country are minimal. You spend most of your time meeting your basic human needs. So what we saw is an increasing amount of friction between migrants and their descendants and the people who'd been here possibly, you know, since Federation or before Federation, their descendants. We saw this increasing friction because of decreasing jobs, decreasing wages, decreasing unionisation, decreased collective bargaining. But the fact is, and this is what people tend to forget, the fact is the great majority of migrants who came to this country came here looking for a better life. They came here legally. They came here to assist the country. And if there are negative consequences of migration, those negative consequences are not due to the people that have arrived as migrants and their descendants, but those negative consequences to a significant proportion of Australian society are directly related to government policies which assist the corporate sector to maximise their profits. So what we see in 2025 is unscrupulous political elements, not just in this country but around the globe, exploiting racial divisions for short-term political gains. And I think it's important that people understand there are victims on both sides. That the issue isn't somebody's colour or the language they speak or the funny clothes they wear or their sexual orientation. The central issue is the centralisation of power and wealth. Because during the last 40 to 50 years, during the deregulation, privatisation, corporatisation, deregulation tsunami that swept over the country, there have been elements of society, very small elements, especially the 1% that own the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication, who have profited greatly from this country's migration policies. Think about it. You're listening to The Anarchist World this week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. Now, remember that song from about 25 years ago, Don't Worry, Be Happy? Look, it reminds me of the coalition, the opposition. No wonder votes are hemorrhaging to One Nation from the coalition. Now, we've just seen a report handed down by scientists, you know, those people you don't believe, that rely on facts, not fiction. It is the end of the first quarter of the 21st century, and obviously, you know, we rely on fiction, not facts. So you've got all these scientists, they're giving us all this garbage facts, you know, like as the temperature increases, there'll be more storms and more floods and more fires and more people will die and, you know, from heat exhaustion and, you know, over a million homes will be inundated. All this factual garbage, you know. Who wants to hear facts? So I'm going to put your mind at ease, all right? Facts are facts, fiction is fiction. Now, if you're concerned about the facts, do what the coalition does. They're not interested in facts. They follow the motto of the Don't Worry, Be Happy song. Don't worry, be happy as your houses burn down. Your homes are flooded. Don't worry. Be happy. It doesn't exist. Climate emergency does not exist. It is fiction. It's fiction because we have a belief system that goes against the facts. That's the beauty of living in the 21st century. So, congratulations to the coalition. It's not a matter of burying your head in the sand because you don't like the view. It's more than that. It's a way of life. It's disbelief. Facts don't matter. It's the 21st century. It's all fake news. There's only one problem. Nature doesn't care. It doesn't care if there isn't one human being on planet Earth. Didn't care when all the dinosaurs disappeared. It doesn't care. There are consequences. There's always consequences. If I walk out in front of a bus, there's a good chance I'm going to be killed or seriously injured. Now, if we're not happy with the facts and we want to shoot the messenger, well and good, but it doesn't change the facts and it doesn't change the trajectory. And to have a major political party, which is a government in waiting, that's tearing itself apart because it doesn't want to face the facts. It's an extraordinary situation. But when you look at what's happening in the United States of America, the gangster nation, you begin to understand that's not facts that count. It's fiction and belief systems. And we laugh about burning witches in the Middle Ages. You listen to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia by the Community Radio Network. Isn't it wonderful? The One Nation Revival. Or I should say the Divided Nation Revival. I don't like using the word One Nation. It's a Divided Nation Revival. Here we have the coalition tearing itself apart. And One Nation saying thank you, thank you. Or the Divided Nation saying thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because all those people out there who believe in fiction, don't worry, it's okay, that's the way it will be. Yeah, so, you know, that's the way it is. So, it's not unexpected, but the thing is, what are the policies of Divided Nation? What are their policies? And if their policies, will they somehow improve the situation of locals? Will somehow introducing those policies and making them legislation will make this country a better country? Well, people need to think about it. But who am I? Who am I to tell people what to do? All I can do is actually try to explain what's happening around us. You're listening to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. This program is streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Now I'm proud today. You know, proud. To be following in the footsteps of the Melbourne Anarchist Club and the Industrial Workers of the World. Now, those of you who are regular listeners to the Anarchist World This Week may know a little bit about the Melbourne Anarchist Club, which was the first anarchist organisation formed in this country on the 1st of May 1886, and possibly know a little bit about the Industrial Workers of the World during their heyday during World War One. Now, they're important organisations because in the face of an overwhelming majority of people in this country during that period pushing a white Australia policy, pushing policies which would have expelled people and did expel people who had lived here for decades because of the colour of their skin. And although the trade union movement was at the forefront of the 19th century of promoting the White Australia policy to maintain wages, the fact is there were some marginal organisations, like the Melbourne Anarchist Club, which were able to identify the enemy. And they understood the enemy wasn't the exploited worker who was exploited by business and business owners, their labour was exploited to maximise profits for them and put downward pressure on wages. It wasn't because they were Chinese or because they're African. They understood that the central issue was inequalities in power and wealth. And it didn't matter who had their foot on your neck, whether it was a black foot, a yellow foot, or a white foot. The problem was that foot on your neck. And as anarchists, we're proud to say that historically, we're one of the few cultural and political and social groupings and organisations which have promoted ideas regarding an equality which is not based on race or sexual orientation or gender, but an equality which is based on the idea that we suffer a common form of exploitation, and that's the exploitation of our labour, whether it's skilled or unskilled, in order to create profits for owners. Industrial workers of the world, once again, highlighted the fact that it wasn't a person's colour or culture which was central to that struggle to create a more egalitarian community. It was the fact that power and wealth was concentrated in the hands of a minuscule minority. And much of their propaganda work in this country was based on the idea of racial equality. So as anarchists, or people who have an interest in anarchism, a central tenet is the fact that we have been at the forefront of that struggle to promote equality irrespective of gender, race, culture, and the list goes on and on. So this is something we should all be proud of, despite the utilisation of dissatisfaction in our community, growing dissatisfaction in our community, which is directed at minorities, whether it's First Nations people, whether it's recent immigrants, whether it's people who have a different religion. The fact is that we have, to a significant degree, been at the forefront of that struggle against the emerging hysteria and hatred which has been created in this society in order to facilitate the type of countries which we saw in the 1930s, where once these elements seized state power, as we've seen to a more limited degree in the US of A, the land of the brave and the free, we can actually see what happens when these myopic individuals capture state power and they use their ability to intimidate people through their manipulation of state power in order to introduce policies which divide us as a people and as a nation. You listen to The Anarchist World this week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. Gaza, from carnage to genocide. It's fascinating, isn't it? Now, the Palestinians are an occupied people. Right? They've been occupied by the creation of the Israeli state. Now, theoretically, if a nation is involved in an inter-Sinai civil war, as we saw in Kampuchea, now Cambodia, in the 70s, the world tends to stand aside and say, well, it's a civil war, as we see in the Sudan currently. But you see, the Gaza and the West Bank and the East Jerusalem situation is very different. This is an occupied zone, a zone which has been occupied militarily by the Israeli authorities. Now, under so-called international law, they are afforded protections as an occupied people. Now, the carnage that's occurring in Gaza, carnage which is now has turned into genocide, is basically being accepted by the West as a fait accompli. We're not seeing Western governments, and I exclude the United States of America from that, applying the sanctions that they're applying against Russia in the Russia-Ukrainian war. We're not seeing any limitations in the amount of armaments which can be bought by Israel. We're not seeing the Israeli pariah state, which is headed by a war criminal, being held accountable for what are deplorable actions of the Israeli Defence Forces. So what is happening in Gaza reflects the inability of states or the United Nations to respond to any significant outrage anywhere on the planet unless it has the support of the five major powers which have a veto option in the United Nations. And the five major powers are Britain, China, the United States, France, Britain, China, the United States, France, and Russia. So, if we can tolerate a genocide which is brought to our attention on a day-to-day basis and do nothing about it, apart from individuals attempting to reach Gaza through flotillas which will be pushed aside by the Israeli Defence Forces and by people marching in the streets on a regular basis and by others attempting to blockade weapons being sent or components of weapons being sent to Israel. The fact is that as far as governments are concerned, especially in the West, which prides itself on its respect for human rights and the rule of law and democratic institutions, it highlights the bankruptcy of the system that we find ourselves in at the end of the first quarter of the 21st century. What can I say? It is there. The evidence is there. You didn't need 23 months to call it a genocide. You didn't need 23 months to call it carnage. You didn't need to see the bodies of over 20,000 children, some who were actually targeted by snipers, to know what's going on. Let's move on. Now, I'd just like to remind you of a few dates that you may be interested in. I'd like to remind you of Peter Norman Day, which is Thursday the 9th, and I'll be talking about that next week. That's Thursday the 9th of October, midday, down at the Oval. I'll be discussing that next week on the program. Also like to remind you of Reclaiming the Rika Rebellion Commemorations, which will be held in Ballarat from 4 a.m. onwards on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, which you're all welcome to attend. Now, it's interesting. I have found it interesting that when we've seen these protests against mass migration and we've seen Adolf's Freaks, you know, parade, that they seem to have lost their love for the Eureka flag, but love the Union Jack, obviously, the Australian flag. And that's good to see because, you see, the trouble is with a belief system, which isn't based, you know, no belief system is based on facts. That's why it's a belief system. People tend to misconstrue history to suit their short-term gains. Now, just in case you're not aware of it, the Eureka Rebellion was based on four principles. Internationalism, direct action, direct democracy, and solidarity. Now, I'm not going to go into it today, but I would like to look at the internationalist phase of the Eureka Rebellion. As I said at the beginning, it's not the colour of your skin or the language you speak or your religion that matters in the struggle to create a more egalitarian community. It's the nature of the oppression you suffer. And on the goldfields across Victoria, including Ballarat, we saw a corrupt, oppressive colonial authority attempt to control a movement which was based on the idea of creating a new world free of the strictures, the class strictures of the old world of the Northern Hemisphere in the Southern Hemisphere. And if you look at the history and look at the people that are buried in the mass grave, you'll see people of all colours, all religions. They came together to fight the British colonial authorities. They came together because of their common oppression. They understood their oppression. And to somehow think that the Eureka flag has anything to do with white nationalism is beyond belief. And it's good to see the more erudite elements in the anti-migration movement have now realised that the Eureka flag is not their flag. The Eureka flag is our flag. It's a flag of inclusion. It's a flag of struggle against oppression. It's not a flag that divides people. It's not a flag that can be waved around by some, you know, thug thinking that somehow, you know, it's about recreating some white Australian mythical society which has never existed in this country. So I encourage you to join us for the Eureka celebrations on Wednesday the 3rd of December in Ballarat, starting at 4 a.m. And as we get closer, I'll speak more about those celebrations. But that reminds me, in 2002, feeling sick and tired about the type of people which were able to obtain the upper, how shall I put it, the upper awards, you know, the higher awards in the Order of Australia, you know, the usual political hacks, the usual corporate exploiters, we set up the Eureka Australia Medal. And on the 3rd of December at Bakery Hill, the very site where the Eureka Oath was taken on the 29th of November 1854, we swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other and fight to defend our rights and liberties. We will be awarding 6 Eureka medals to people living in this country who have made a contribution, and in the majority of cases, a contribution that's been ignored, marginalised, pushed aside. to the creation of a more egalitarian community. So if you know somebody who you think should receive a Eureka Medal, nominations close by mid-November, I encourage you to send your nominations to, you can either phone them in on 0439 395 489. You can put them down on a piece of paper and send them to Post Office Box 20, Parkville 3052. Or you can email to them info@anarchistmedia.org or info@pibci.net. We need a name, some words about why this person is worthy of a Eureka Australia Medal, and a contact point, if possible. So, don't forget, let's move on. Chalk and cheese. Now, I know facts are boring and, you know, you need to do a song and dance to make history palatable to the greater number. Something I don't want to do, basically. But I am interested in the differences between, over the last 50 years, the differences between the Whitlam-led Labor government and the Albanese-led Labor government. Now, both governments have been in power for around 1,000 days. The Whitlam-led Labor government was in power for 1,061 days. The Albanese-led Labor government has been in power for over 1,000 days. And I'm interested in looking at their historical record, because the Labor Party prides itself on being a reform-orientated party, a little bit different to the coalition, which is about the status, maintaining the status quo, or, you know, dragging the country back to some mythical age which never existed, or acting basically as cockatoos for the corporate sector. So, if I gave you a piece of cheese and I gave you a piece of chalk to chew on, I am sure you would be able to work out the difference pretty quickly, because chalk and cheese, doesn't matter how terrible the cheese is, it's got a different taste. Now, when I talk about the Whitlam-led Labor government, I am talking about a country that had been under a coalition government for 23 years, from 1949 to 1972. A country which was ready for change. Because the Labor Party wasn't elected in 1972, and I think the 3rd of December 5th of December 1972, as an entity which didn't have any contact with the Australian people. It came after years of struggle against conservative elements who used hatred and fear as their calling cards. And those of us who are old enough to remember the election campaigns during the 50s and 60s will remember that it was all about fear. I remember the dramatic picture of the yellow hordes, the big yellow arrow coming down from Cambodia and Vietnam into Malaysia and then into Australia. And every election which was pushed by the Menzies-led Liberal Country Party coalition was about fear. And it wasn't until 1972 that a government was elected which reflected that bent-up desire for change. And tonight, which is the 17th, if you're listening to this program live, it's the 17th of September, I'll be doing a presentation at the Footscray Hotel starting at 7 p.m. on the differences. And the differences between the Whitlam-led Labor government and the Albanese-led Labor government 50 years later, as I said, is the difference between chalk and cheese. The Whitlam Labor government's primary objective was the redistribution of wealth. Now, obviously, they made mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. I make mistakes every day I walk into this studio. The fact that I've walked into a studio is a mistake, isn't it? But when you look at what the Albanese government has done, especially during its second term, when it has a record majority, which no Australian government has had since Federation, you begin to shake your head in disbelief. Well, the Whitlam-led Labor government was about a reform agenda, about redistribution of wealth. The Albanese government seems to be hell-bent on a steady-as-you-go course, allowing the 1% that own the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication to continue to dominate every aspect of our existence, whether it's culture, whether it's social, whether it's human interaction, whether it's economics. We find ourselves in this situation constantly. It's just a few of the reforms which I'll be talking about this evening. Well, I think the presentation will be about an hour. I'll spend about 30 seconds on the Albanese Labor government's reforms in the last 1,000 days. And I'll be spending, 59 minutes and 30 seconds speaking about the Whitlam-led Labor reforms. Things like a Racial Discrimination Act, Australia's First Environment Act, the establishment of a trade union college, the establishment of principals to give rank and file back control of their unions, the establishment of single parents' benefits, only widowed women could receive a pension before 1973, which meant many women who had children out of wedlock were forced to adopt them. And we saw the harm that this has caused to a generation of women in the 50s and 60s. We saw the introduction of legal reform, community legal centres, community health centres. Me broadcasting here on community radio is courtesy of the Whitlam-led Labor government passing legislation to allow communities to set up radio stations to try to break the monopoly that the Murdoch media had in this country in terms of fashioning ideas and opinions. We had the introduction of Medibank, which is now Medicare, the single most important health initiative, which was opposed by every major and minor doctors' organisation in this country in 1973. And it took a double disillusion election in 1974 for Medibank to come into existence. And despite the efforts of multiple conservative governments to destroy the essence of Medibank, now Medicare, it continues to survive. We have land rights, the first land rights legislation in this country. The ability of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders to elect representatives to a body. The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, I think it was a commission, to advise the federal government. The setting up of an Aboriginal Affairs Bureau ministry within the bureaucracy, headed by the radical Charlie Perkins, the Australian Film Foundation. The fact that the Whitlam-led federal government bypassed conservative state governments and directly funded local governments to provide sewerage services which had not been introduced in this country, to provide money to prepare pavements, make roads. And those in the agricultural sector had never had it so good. When tariffs were reduced, agricultural profits increased by 300% over a four-year period, and the list goes on and on, which I'll speak about tonight. But the fact is, what's the point of having a huge majority in Parliament and a relatively sympathetic Senate. Because let's not forget, the Whitlam-led Labor government never had a majority in the Senate. And that's what's led to its dismissal on the 11th of November 1975. And just in case you're interested in the historical record, the Anarchist Marine Institute will be organising a little picnic on the steps of the Victorian Parliament House starting at midday on Tuesday, the 11th of November, to celebrate the achievements of a reformist government which was interested in economic redistribution, not creation of wealth for a shrinking minority. You've been listening to The Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia by the Community Radio Network. This program has been streaming live on 3cr.org.au. That's 3cr.org.au. The program is a podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. You can leave messages on 0439 395 489. 0439 395 489. YouTube channels, Public Interest Before Corporate Interest, josephtoscano.com, which was a historical YouTube channel. You can write to us. Yes, we still answer mail to Post Office Box 20, Parkville 3052. Post Office Box 20, Parkville 3052. And the list goes in. Facebook page, Joseph Toscano. Net pages, Public Interest Before Corporate Interest. You can join today, PIBCI.net. The list goes on and on. Just go on the web and you'll find all that stuff. But more importantly, come and support us during our public housing vigils on the steps of the Victorian Parliament House every Thursday, 12 till 1. Come to the Peter Norman Day on the 9th of October. Come along to the Francesco Fantine Memorial Day on the 9th, Sunday the 9th of November. Join us for the Eureka celebrations on the 3rd of December. Many options, many things, not just what I talk about on this program, many other organisations out there which are doing their best to counter the fiction which has become part and parcel of everyday life. When a war criminal can address the United Nations and a buffoon can act as a gangster in Washington, it's time for us to organise and fight back. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World This Week on your local community radio station, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. This program has been streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. Listen in to your local community radio station next week for The Anarchist World This Week.
This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.